Record to this. Okay, good. All right, gentlemen, it is, let's see, hold on, look at my watch here. It is Tuesday, August 18th, 2026. Pete, what number is this?
This is not AI Pete. I am not a robot. I am not computer generated. This is Solder Smoke Podcast 266. Crank it up, Robert. Crank it up, Ralph.
Well, we'd like to believe you, Pete, put the scare quotes there, Pete. But that's what they all the robots would say, right? Right, Dean?
You're absolutely right, Bill.
We're not in the uncanny valley.
I love it when the AI tells me that I'm absolutely right. I'm absolutely right. I heard that there's actually a t-shirt that they're producing in California where all it says is, "You're absolutely right." Well, we'll talk a little bit more about AI in a second. But first, we have some travel log to talk about. Dean, you were in Boston.
I was in Boston for with my son and daughter-in-law and our 2-year-old granddaughter, who is now a general. So, Grandpa, sit here. Grandpa, sit there. Grandpa, sit there. No, Grandma, you sit there. So, 2-year-olds.
And she's in charge.
She's absolutely in charge. So, but that was a lot of fun. We did a little bit of walk along the Freedom Trail and saw all the Patriot graves and Paul Revere's ride and all that kind of stuff. It was a nice little trip. But we had 2 weeks of grandchildren, which is, they're delightful when they're here, and it's peaceful when they've gone home. It's,
And
you know,
you
that's
turn them over to their parents. You say, "Here."
yeah.
And I haven't been doing too much traveling, but I was out at Glenmore in Maryland, which is a big estate out there that has been turned into kind of an art museum. And Elisa likes to go there. We went there with my sister, and we walked around the thing. That was really nice. And I guess this leads to, and Pete, I don't think you've been doing too much traveling. You've been staying home plate.
Right. Take it easy.
Take it easy. All right. But this brings us to the next topic, because this Saturday I was out in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is the next county over, and it is sort of ground zero for the data center. So this leads us to a discussion, I guess, a brief discussion. We'll briefly talk about AI, but I got to tell you, when we rode through Loudoun County, you start seeing these things right away. And they're big. The folks who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, imagine huge buildings with no windows, one door, no parking, right? And you say to yourself, "Wow, what's that thing?" And you realize, well, that's a data center. Then when you see a few data centers, you think, "Oh, that's a lot of data centers." Then you ride down the road a bit and you start seeing data centers under construction, future data centers. There's a lot of data centers out there. So this gets us into a discussion of AI and ham radio. So what do you guys think?
Well, Virginia is kind of data center capital, one of the big data center capitals because of the prevalence of the Beltway Bandits and the big companies. Loudoun County, not too long ago was rural, it is not anymore. It's filled with people and data centers. So the land that was left now has data centers in it. So it's part of the technological revolution. When they started building data centers 25, 30 years ago, when I was doing computer tech, it would the big thing then was, well, you don't have to have your own computer room. You can just put your computers in our data center. And then it's, well, you don't even have to have your own computers. You can just lease some of our computers. Now you don't even do that. You just pay for the use of them by the minute. And with AI, you're not even doing that, because by all in reporting, the AI industry is spending trillions so far to earn billions. And those numbers, it's going to be a while before those numbers catch up.
I was telling, we were talking a little bit in the minutes before we opened the podcast. I was telling Pete about some of the responses that I've been getting on the Solder Smoke blog. I've been encouraging people to do comments on the blog posts, and most of them have been great. But there's a surprising backlash to AI. And if a lot of time I was telling Pete, I devote probably 2 or 3 minutes to each one of these posts. So if AI gives me a good answer to whatever question I'm looking at, I just do copy paste, boom, and I'm done. And then this provokes response. Why are you putting that AI slop up there? You should be using Wikipedia. And I kind of, well, I get it, but on the other hand, AI, as we know it right now, is kind of a misnomer, and it's in a lot of ways it's just sort of an expansion on the Google search engine or the search engine. And if you didn't object to the Google search engine before, I don't know why you're so adamantly opposed to the use of AI now.
Well, Bill, why do you use Wikipedia when you got a perfectly good Encyclopedia Britannica filling 30 volumes on the bookshelf right behind you?
Right behind me, right there. I should be looking it up and then I should retype it. But wait a second, why am I using this computer thingy at all? Huh? Huh? Yeah, why? Anyway, these are the kind of issues
Well,
we face.
I think you've made the point before, though, that the tool is the tool, right? And it can produce slop or it can produce useful information. If it produces useful information, the information is still useful. Whether it came from the AI summary or not, it's still useful information. The challenge with ham radio and what we do is it's not particularly good at that circuit diagram behind Pete's head. It's just not great at that. It does some of the things well. Like it can calculate the bias on an amplifier and things like that, and it can read data sheets and explain them and that sort of thing. But when it gets down to really analyzing a circuit and really debugging a circuit, it's just not really useful for us yet. Although I have used it for that, so I spent hours like with an amplifier saying, well, try this, and it'll say, well, reduce this resistor, reduce, and it's, then I realize, all right, this is a predictive word engine. Doesn't really know the electronics. So where's it getting that insight about the size of the resistor I should be using there? So it's just be careful. That's, I think, it's much better as an assistant and not as a designer of a thing.
Yeah, I came across some of these shortcomings because a really well-known home brewer from Japan, JA9MAT, had sent me a circuit, and he said, "Look at this super regenerative receiver." And so I just wanted a sort of an analysis of the circuit, so I uploaded the diagram that he had sent me, and AI came back and said, "It's just a regenerative receiver. It's not a super regenerative receiver." There's a big difference between the two. And then I said to it, I said, "Are you sure?" And they said, "Yeah, I'm sure." And they kind of confirmed that they were sure that it was a regenerative receiver. Then I went back and I checked it again. And I said, "Wait a second. No, have you looked at this part and this circuit, this element? Why do they have them there? It must be super regenerative." And then I got the response.
You're absolutely right, Bill.
I
It
was
is a
absolutely
regenerative
right.
effect.
It
Thank
was right.
you.
It was super regenerative. Thank you. That was good. So you're right. It's not too good at analyzing the circuit. Anyway, Dean has stepped away for a second, and so let's go ahead, Pete. Why don't you tell us about your bench? Why don't we just skip forward and oh, wait, no, he's back. He's back. He's back. He's gonna put in his headphones. He's gonna do this now. There he goes. He's back. All right, Dean.
I had to let Walter in the room. He was banging at the door.
Walter will not be denied the entry to the room. All right, Dean, we were going to go ahead with your portion. Dean's bench.
All
Over to
right.
you,
Well,
Dean.
I don't know if you heard Walter. There he was. He's just saying good morning. Good morning, Walter. Be
Good morning,
quiet.
Walter.
So I've been thinking a lot about troubleshooting, and it comes from several things. One is, since I started doing this now 7 or 8 years ago with your guys' help, I have climbed a mountain and learned an awful lot about these things. And I made every mistake that all beginners make. And as we work with the guys on the Discord channel, I find people making the mistakes over and over again that I made, and trying to help them kind of see a way to go through troubleshooting these things. Some of them don't listen. Some of them just won't listen at all. Some will listen, but there are a few basics that I think it's well worth reminding ourselves of. and that troubleshooting a circuit you built starts before you build the circuit, right? It starts with kind of careful layout. So one of our guys is having problems with a 5-watt amplifier. He's got oscillation. Well, we know that there are half a dozen things that contribute to oscillation where you can get that the Barkhausen criteria met and the feedback, and we know that there are some basic guidelines for building an amplifier. Keep the inputs away from the outputs, right? Well, he had in one case the low pass filter, output filter, physically next to the driver circuit. So he ran a coax from the output of the output of the IRF510 all the way around the board to the other end of the board. So the low pass filter was physically next to the. He said, "Well, I moved it, didn't change anything." That doesn't matter. It's still a basic principle that keep your inputs away from the output, keep your leads short, keep your ground solid, keep your grounds well bonded between the boards of your, these are all things that we learn over time and mistakes that we make, or just not having good solder joints to the board, right? So if you start with good layout, good basic principles, you may never even get to the point where you have to debug that board.
Yeah, I
But
mean,
then when
I think the thing about keeping the leads short, keeping good solder joints, it's so fundamental. But you get a lot of guys who come from the digital world where it doesn't matter. Just plug a whole bunch of stuff in the breadboard and it'll work. But not so much with RF.
Yeah, and then there's the learning how to use your tools and learning what tools are the right tools to use for the right problem. So an oscilloscope is a great tool, but only if you don't have the probe set for 1x and the scope set for 10x, or you're on the wrong mode of the scope, or you're not DC filtering, or you've got the 20 megahertz bandwidth on. So they're good tools, but they're sophisticated tools, and it is worth investing some time to understand how to use them. Watch any of W2AEW Alan Wolke's video tutorials on oscilloscopes, and you'll get a good start. I mean, we did this in the Discord channel. I put a basic video up about here's how to set up your scope to measure our circuit, and that's one set of guidelines. But if you're measuring audio, you do different things. If you're measuring RF, you do different things. If you've got high level signals, you do something. If you've got very weak signals, you got to do something different. And then learning to understand what the traces on the scope mean. What does a sine wave mean? We've had guys say, "Look, I have a perfect sine wave," and I'm like, that's great, except at that point in the circuit, you're supposed to have a squared off wave because it's switching diodes, right? So understanding what you're looking at, because it can be a challenge. But the other thing is our inexpensive scopes. I'll just put it out there. They have inexpensive probes. They're cheap, right? They sell them for like $10 a piece. There's a reason that Agilent sells their scope probes for $125 a piece. And there's a reason why Rigol and the others sell theirs for $10 a piece. And there is a difference. And the probes are cheap, so you have to be careful with them. I found that on mine, that the probe that I use most frequently, the little springy thing that with the spring clip, I don't always get a good connection to the part that I'm measuring. And you know this. When you're looking at the signal and it seems way off, and you kind of touch the scope probe, and suddenly it jumps from low to high, and it's like, okay, the probe. So my instrument is lying to me because my probe is got problems, right? So learning how to understand what your instruments are telling you is important. Pete, you've made the point before that people will say, "Well, I hooked up the VNA and everything's perfect." Well, not necessarily. You've hooked up the VNA and you got some kind of trace on your screen and it looks pretty. But unless you understand how to set up the VNA, how to make sure you've got the bandwidth at the right level, we've had people trying to look at FFT transforms on the output of the mixer for the direct conversion receiver. Well, the output of the mixer is a 1 kilohertz tone. And if you're putting in two signals that are 1 kilohertz apart, You got to have a bandwidth resolution that's going to be allow you to see that, or you'll never even see it on the scope. So they start looking for things that aren't there because they don't understand the basic way to use these tools. And there are many, many, many videos that are available. And again, Alan, we tout him all the time. He's got a great set of videos just on using a VNA and explains everything about all the different settings that you use. Watch him, learn him, practice. That's the other thing that I've learned is if I build small versions of the circuit, take the big board away and just build the one amplifier stage, really learn that stage. And then when I've learned that stage, I know how to check it. You know, basics. When you're building an amplifier circuit like a common emitter amplifier, check the DC voltages, make sure they're where they need to be before you ever put a signal in, right? And then you've got, you know, because you know that if you've got a 0.7 volt diode drop between the base and the emitter, your transistor is probably going to amplify. It's gonna operate. You may not have the operating point at exactly the right place, and so on and so forth. But you at least know you've got the DC wired right, so that the thing will turn on under proper conditions. So few people do that. They just kind of put stuff on the board, they get it all built at the end, and then they wonder, well, what's wrong? It's not working. Here's the other thing. Once you've built a board and you have exhaustively tested it, trust your results. Don't keep going back to the board that you know is working to change things. I've done that before. You start saying, well, I can't figure it out. It must be over here. And so you go back to a board that was working and you make it not work, right? So this idea that you know, starting to write down and record your measurements and then trust them. And then sometimes it's a good idea to go back and verify the measurements and just say, all right, I know when I built this board, these were the DC voltages on the leads. Let me double check that. And if they've changed, aha, there's a clue. You know something's wrong. Touch tests. Touch tests is one of the things that people don't believe you can diagnose boards by touching, but you absolutely can.
Yes.
If you touch a component and something changes, stop and think about why it changed. Do you have capacitance, straight capacitance from your hand? Do you most likely have a cold solder joint? Is it on, you know, which lead is it on? It may not be the one you think it is. You know, all those sorts of things are the kinds of things that can help you with debugging. And then be methodical. Don't be random. Don't just kind of jump around the board and poke at things. Think about, all right, where is the signal good? Where does it stop being good? Where is there, under what conditions does my amplifier oscillate? What makes it stop oscillating? You know, those are the kind of clues that can kind of get you there. And you just got to do more of it. You got to get in the habit of doing it. But, you know, in music, they say practice makes perfect. And then the music teacher says, no, 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 no. Perfect practice makes perfect, right? So practice good techniques, get them built into your head, learn to use your tools. Understand your circuit before you start poking around at it. And one last thing, do not take advice from every last Yahoo on the internet, because this happens often in our Discord channel. They'll say, well, so and so posted a video where he made this thing happen. And I'm looking at him and saying, that video is not reliable. That guy that says he's getting 100 watts out of his IRF 510, he's got oscillation that he's not even seeing because it's not even on his scope. That's not physically possible with that part, those kind of things. So be careful who you listen to. We give references all the time to guys like Alan, W2AW, very reputable. You know, read any one of Pete's large archive of projects that he's built, because he shows you how to build them and how to measure them and what you should be looking for. But find the reliable people and go back to them, and then get some books. Get that copy of Solder Smoke's Design for the, or Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur, or Experimental Methods in RF Design. That's even available on ARL now. It's back in print, so you can get it. And then, you know, read the articles and learn. I have amassed over 7 or 8 years, 500 or 600 different articles, I think, on different projects. So when I start building like my 100-watt amplifier, I search for every possible article on it in QEX and RSGB and the various publications. I looked for builders that I knew that built it. I looked for Motorola design notes, and I built an archive of these things. And guess what? Now with AI, you can even search your own archive. Not slop, your own archive of reliable information. So anyway, that's my pitch on debugging your circuits.
I'm just going to make a couple comments before turning it over to Pete, because this is a good, really good segue for him to go in to talk about his circuits. But I just wanted to point to Pete and say he was, first of all, he was the guy who told us about Barkhausen. Before Pete, we didn't know from Barkhausen. The second thing is a great quote from Pete that's very applicable here, and that is, the radio is not going to build itself. All right. So a lot of times you'll hear guys getting frustrated, especially if they start building transmitters and they start building RF amplifiers at the 5 watt stage. That's hard. It's hard. We've all been there. We've all had trouble. We've all had oscillations. And you've got to go through it in using the techniques that Dean described to sort of fix it, to make it stable, to get it to work. And everything I think Dean has said is right on the money. But Pete, let me turn it over to you because I know you've got some comments in this area also.
My second part of my comments dovetails just exactly what Dean said. I wanted to share a video that I saw on YouTube from LA6NCA, Helgi. But before I do that, I just wanted to I was pondering a little bit about amateur radio operators and how we have a common bond that ultimately, when we get on the air and make a contact, then we feel pretty good about it, whether it's a DX contact or a local contact. And then I was thinking about the different kinds of operators. We have people who use commercial gear. They have the IC7300 and the FT710, and they make a lot of contacts. And when they're done, it's exciting. Then you have the type that build a kit. They get all the parts and packages, put the kit together, they get on the air, they make contacts, and they really feel good about after having built the kit successfully, they've made some contacts. Then we have that group of amateurs that sees an article and says, I'm going to replicate that. And so they get all the parts and they build it and they put that on air and get exciting. But the last group is where Helgi comes in. That's the group that designs the whole rig, puts it together, and then makes contacts with it. And I know personally, I get really excited about something that I had just an idea, put some kind of design together, and finally put it on the air and make some contacts with it. And you have, it's exciting to make the contact, but it's even more exciting because something has started with an idea on paper, and suddenly now it's hardware. And this is what this video by LA6NCA is about. And it's a two-tube transceiver. Two-tube transceiver, and this thing is comprised of three Eltoid boxes. One box has a key, and the key he made 3D printed, so it's a 3D printed key. So it's something he built with his, he had to design and build with his own hands. And then second box is the power supply, and this is amazing because this whole thing was designed by him. And he made a high voltage power supply, a switching power supply, and he used some pretty common circuit devices we're familiar with. He built a an oscillator, a four using a 4047 IC, and essentially it produces two outputs, Q and not Q, so they're out of phase. And he drives the gates on two IR 510s, and he pulses the primary of this transformer, and then the secondary produces 250 volts DC, so from 12 volts to 250 volts, and the whole thing is in an Eltoid stand. So he can go out on a park bench with a 12-volt battery and using a tube rig operate the tubes. And he's got all the schematics in there. So you, if you look at this article, you say, gee, I need a power supply. He can just do what he does. The receiver is kind of fascinating because he, as he says, he totally designed himself and has two tubes. Got his 6BE6, which is a pentagrid converter, and a 6AQ5, which is a power amplifier. In a receive mode, it's used as a direct conversion receiver, and part of the tube is an oscillator. So it's a direct conversion single channel crystal on 80 meters. And so then he, in the plate circuit of the 6BE6, he actually has two individual circuits. One on the receive part is like an RC filter, so he cuts out some of the hiss. And then in a transmit part, the relay switch is a tank circuit, so the output of the tank feeds the 6AQ5. The 6AQ5 and in the receive mode has two things in the output, and it's you look at it and you say, I'll be damned. He's got a speaker transformer in there, and then he's got a tank network for the transmitter. So when he goes to transmit, he shorts out the primary of the speaker transformer, so all you're seeing is the tank network. So he also does another thing, is he adjusts the screen grid on transmit so he can get more power out of it. So he gets about 2 watts of RF. And then the antenna system is kind of interesting. He uses 4 20-foot fishing poles, so that you have two of them are an A-frame over here, two of them A-frame over here, and he puts a dipole between. He's sitting on a bench here making contacts. And it's exciting in the sense that everything is home built, but you're looking at it, Eltosh did, and he said, you if you built the transceiver, you might want to build a bigger chassis, because that thing is jam-packed with stuff. So when you look at that, you say, just think, this guy had an idea. It's his circuit. He designed it totally and completely. He does another thing for side tone. He gets a relay coil, and he has the relay coil buzzing, and then he, before he takes the output of that, he puts some RC filtering on it, so he creates a side tone using a relay. I mean, you look at that thing and say, it's amazing. And he's in the last category. He had all these ideas, put them on paper, he built them, and he successfully operated it. So, I mean, hats off. You got to see this thing, because it's just so amazing. And I would say, what satisfaction he gets as a result of putting this all the stuff together, starting out with a blank sheet of paper and a pencil, and the next thing you know, he's sitting on a picnic bench.
No, it's a wonderful video, and I have links to it up on the Solder Smoke blog, and or you could just go through YouTube and take a look at it. I agree. I was really blown away by the circuit too. You know, I thought for sure that he was going to have some sort of regen receiver on that thing, but it's a direct conversion receiver. It's just amazing. And then, like you mentioned, the side tone could be a showstopper. I mean, I remember when I first started building homebrew rigs, I got to the point where it was done, and I thought I was done, and wait, no, the side tone. You got to do side tone. Oh, he also does the conversion, I think, the for how you know to get the 700 hertz split.
The cap.
That he's got it. It's amazing. No, the whole thing is terrific. I agree with you. I'm sure Dean does too,
And
with that.
it also is a reminder that things that look like they're simple circuits often are very much more complex than you think they are, because he's jamming a ton of functionality into two tubes, right? And so having to switch transmit and receive, having to reuse parts of the circuit, having to turn off parts of the circuit when you go. And so when you first glance at a schematic like that, my reaction is, what the heck is all of this? You know, and it's like, how can that possibly work? Well, learning to read a schematic is another one of those debugging tools, so that you kind of know what you're looking at. And then you made one other point, Pete, that I had meant to make, which is, don't cause yourself more problems by trying to jam things in a board that's too small for the thing you're building, unless you're like a super expert at things and you know exactly what you're doing. Because once you got things packed so tightly, you can't unsolder them, you can't get your probes on them, the leads touch each other, getting things too tight can be just as bad as having big long stray leads all over the place.
The tank circuit, Dean, I thought was kind of cool. He 3D printed the form so that it would fit in the Eltosh then. He says, yeah, this is the whole secret, so you can't be haphazard about it. A lot of thought went into that.
No, a lot of thought went into it, and yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's as Dean said, you know, we're big advocates of having a lot of room. And it makes life becomes more difficult when you try to jam the thing into a tiny little space. Especially if you're dealing with RF, the opportunities for feedback are just multiplied once you try to put them into a little box. This is probably why I have big boxes here. And I follow Frank Jones's example. Jones used to start out with a piece of pine board and then put the parts down, keeping the Gesundes away from the Gesaudes. And even at VHF, he was able to get the thing to work. So yeah,
So,
that's
I will point out though that some of this is your fault, Pete. You and your shirt pocket transceiver. I mean, come on. So that's the other. There's the other point. There's a difference between Pete being Pete and being Helge and being me, right? What do they say? A man's got to know his limitations.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. Me too. We all. And it's good to know your limitations. Because, for example, I know that I'm just not that good at the digital stuff. So this is one of the reasons I go with, usually, to Pete's consternation, LC-VFOs.
But
It's
it
also
works. But it works.
the reason you come back to the Dominican Republic so I can come over and troubleshoot for you. That's right. I have to come back. I have to beg for assistance every time I've used an SI5351 or an Arduino, with the interface, the graphical user interface. I've got stuck and I can't get it to compile, and I have to go talk to somebody else. I have to ask Dean to come over and fix it for me. Anyway, it's good to know your limitations. Pete, you were going to also talk about
Yeah, troubleshooting.
troubleshooting when the data fools you and the zeros.
Yes. Hanging along, and Dean and I didn't talk before this about troubleshooting, but I ran into something. The guy was working on an assembly, and he says, "I'm going to share with you a secret." He says, "And that secret has got three letters. It's an acronym. DBA." DBA. DBA. And that stands for Diagnose Before Acting. Diagnose Before Acting. He says he spent sometimes when something, it was an engine, he said he'll spend a half an hour going around that engine before it turns anything on just to try to look and see if there's anything, that's obvious. A wire disconnected, a corroded terminal, and a battery. All these sorts of things. He says he doesn't immediately start disconnecting this and disconnecting that. DBA, diagnose before acting. Which brings me to the Zia transceiver. The Zia transceiver. Now, if you go to the go to YouTube and type in N6QW and the plus sign, building the Zia, and you'll see a video that was made in 2015. And this is the first time that I used termination insensitive amplifiers in a transceiver. And I might mention that you can buy a termination insensitive amplifier kit from mostly DIY RFCOM. Todd sells those. So, yeah, but in this case, as you see that video, I had to come up with a circuit board that I cut out on my CNC mill so I could put all the transistors and parts in there. For those who are not familiar, the TIA amplifier, termination insensitive amplifier by Hayward and Kopsky, essentially it's a bulletproof amplifier. It doesn't care what you hang on it; it'll always have a constant impedance. And the other thing that's fascinating about the circuitry is you can adjust the gain of the circuit by just changing some resistors. So you can either have a 10 dB or 25 dB, anywhere in between. And that's what makes it nice because you don't necessarily want to have a 25 dB gain amplifier as the first RF amplifier in a transceiver. So, but this built a whole transceiver, and at the original building, which you'll see in there, it's got a Nokia display in it, and that Nokia is black and white. And it was just terrible. You had to be dead on it. You can't look at it from the side. And that particular transceiver has gone through a couple changes, and most recently I put a ST7735 display in here about a year ago, And I dug it out of the box and put it on the air, and it just the receiver seemed dead. The transmitter worked okay, but the receiver seemed dead. And the circuit behind me is something I came up with about 10 years ago, and really it's a relay steered stage, so it uses two 2N3904s. One leg is transmit, the other leg is receive, and the relays switch between them. So like you would have this as the pre-driver stage on transmit and receiver RF amplifier on receive. So the transmit part was working, and I said, before I do anything, let me think about this. The receive part worked, but it was really low. It was low output. And I said, well, if it's working okay on transmit, we know all the transmit stations are good. We know that the common stages, the T and the crystal filter and the product detector balance modulator, and we know that the receiver, a mixer and transmitter mixer are okay. So it's got to take us somewhere ahead of that stage. And but I said, but why am I still hearing signals? But they're weak, they're low. So I said, it's got to be that one transistor. So I pulled the transistor out. It's a 2N3904. Put a new one in there. Boom, it came on. So then I said, well, let's do a little diagnosis here. Why was I able to receive some signals? Because I had an external signal generator about 5 feet away, and I'd pick it up, but it wasn't loud. Well, I reasoned that there was enough spillover, even though the transistor was out and it was about 10 dB a gain, there was still enough signal that it would leak through. So you're picking up the leak through signal. So when I was replacing that transistor, but I mean, I could have torn that whole transceiver apart without spending some time trying to diagnose really what the problem was. So diagnose before acting is probably something you ought to get tattooed on your arm before you go do any troubleshooting. And once I did that, then everything worked fine.
You know, the design, the DBA thing really kind of appeals to me, because a while back on the podcast, we were talking about how the sequence really should be, and this is sort of an expansion on the DBA thing. The sequence should be design and then build, but in that order, design and then build. Too often in my projects, and I think in the projects of some others, it's been sort of reversed. Build. And then scratch your head, figure out why it doesn't work. And then you think, oh, wait, I probably should have designed this first. The other thing I'll mention, just I wanted to mention one thing. You mentioned that the termination insensitive or TIA amps. We came to call them Zia amps because that was more Italian. The ant impedance, and also Zia is ant, you know, and so we were going to use that, but I remember the first time I heard about the TIAs was when I was building one of the BidX20 receivers. I was building it for 17, and I was trying to figure out how you would match the impedance, because at this point, Farhan was not using termination insensitive amps. So if it was going through the crystal filter in transmit, it was facing one set of impedance. But then if it went into the reverse, it was facing another set of impedances because they were not termination insensitive. So I went and asked Farhan about it, and he came back and he said, Bill, he said, what you really should do is you should put termination insensitive amps on either side. Then you know that it's always going to be 50 ohms, and you could just match to whatever the characteristic impedance required by the filter is. So that was, and then it was then that he sent me that article that you mentioned by Hayward and Kopke. And that was when I started using the termination insensitive amplifier. So this is another case where I think Farhan is responsible. But
All of these things kind of wind back into kind of where I was talking about. So you talked about impedance matching of the amplifier stages. That is a topic that is more complex than you think it is. It's not simply a matter, often cases of like tossing a resistor on there and measuring something. There's particularly interstage between two stages of an amplifier stage. We tend to think we're at 50 ohms, But between that driver stage and the next stage, it's not a 50 ohm. It's not a 50 ohm circuit necessarily, right? And so be careful when you're building things about the assumptions you're making about things, and try and verify those assumptions. And you know, people will, I've seen guys on our Discord board just run around this simple amplifier worrying about the impedances between the stages. And we've demonstrated over and over again that as we designed it, it works. Don't start, you know, when you know you have a circuit that works, don't start questioning everything else about the circuit and say, well, why is that resistor there? You shouldn't that be the other way around? Shouldn't you? We get a lot of that kind of stuff on there. And it's like, well, trust me now, 138 people have now built our receiver. They all have it working. You too will if you stop changing it and stop asking the questions about why, you know, stop doubting the circuit that you know works.
You know, you mentioned Alan Wolke, and he's recently got a good video out about he all of his videos are good, but he recently has one out that focuses directly on this issue of impedance matching. And I think Alan is one of the few people that I've come across that says that you don't necessarily have to match exactly impedance from input to output. You don't have to do that. You can do that if you want to get maximum power transfer. So probably when you're dealing with power amplifiers, it's more important. But for many of the other amplifiers, it's not really necessary. And I was really kind of pleased to see that coming from a person like Alan, because if you go through a lot of the books will make you believe that unless it's a perfect one-to-one match, it's just not going to work. And as Dean pointed out, we've all had examples where it's not matched and it works just fine.
Yeah, and he gives the example in the video you're talking about of just using a little buffer transistor at the output of a circuit, which takes away most of those needs. You still get the voltage gain that you need, and so on and so forth. You're not putting it in there necessarily for power at that point, but you put an emitter follower in there, and suddenly you've decoupled the two stages, and you're not worried about it anymore.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's much better. You know, when in the example that I was given, where you know that the filter, in other words, in order to level out the shape of the filter, you're going to need, say, 1500 volts, 1500 ohms on either side, right, for it to work properly. If you have the Tia amps, you know that those Tia amps are going to provide 50 ohms, right? And then so you just build a transformer to go from 50 to up to 1000. And 50 up to 1000, you could do it with an L network, you could do it with transformers. In that case, then it really does matter what kind of,
Exactly.
but in many other cases, not that important. Like in the audio amplifier, going into the audio amplifier, probably not that important. It works just fine. Anyway, Pete, this brings us to a part that I always forget.
Shameless Commerce Division.
It is part time for the Shameless Commerce Division. I'm delighted that Pete has already mentioned our good friend Todd up there in the Silicon Forest of Portland, Oregon. Mostly DIY RF. A great website, lots of great parts, lots of little boards. He's got the boards for the termination insensitive amplifiers. And I have bought a bunch of them. He sent me a whole bunch of them. And I use them all the time, and it's great stuff. And the great thing is that, as Pete says, you could change the gain either, and you could have one a receive one next to the transmit one, right? And you could have the transmit one set at one set of gain and the receive one set on the other set of gain. And I've done that, and it's great fun, and it gives you a level of an amount of flexibility in the building of these circuits that is really, really very useful. So anyway, you should all check out Mostly DIY RF. He's got some great websites, great parts, great kits, and check it all out. Good stuff. Please continue to comment on the blog posts. I mean, I groused a little bit about the AI stuff, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. But no, I mean, all of these comments are really appreciated. It's kind of fun to have a dialogue going about, you know, how to approach these circuits, how to approach the repair of some of these older radios, all this kind of stuff. And it's useful. So continue to please put comments on the blog post. And finally, I would say just think about becoming a Patreon sponsor of Solder Smoke. This is really a very useful tool for us, and it's a way that you can express support and become part of the community. I do try to get some of the output that we provide, and either an expanded form or an early form to the Patreon viewers. But I don't think that's really the reason to do it. The reason to do it is because you want to support the podcast and the blog. So please think about doing that if you can. I think that brings me to my bench. This is the Bill's bench portion. I
Bill,
just
what's on your bench, Bill?
thank you, Dean. Thank you for asking. One of the things I do, I've been trying to do as much, or at least try to level out the amount of operating with the amount of building. Many of us who are builders will find that we're spending almost all of our time at that bench building stuff, and not so much time at this bench operating the stuff that we built over there. But I think it is kind of good to kind of balance it out, because there is a social element to the hobby, and it is kind of fun to get on the air and talk to people, especially with sideband rigs. You're getting away from the CW, you're getting away from FT8. You're actually hearing the human voice. You're hearing when the other guy laughs. You hear kind of what accent he's speaking in. It's fun. I like it. So one of the things I like to do is I like to talk to Australia early in the morning. I like to start my day with a 10,000-mile contact. From this place to most places in Australia, it's 10,000 miles. If I go out to VK6, it's even further. It's probably 12,000 miles. The antipode is 14,000 miles, something like that. At that point, you're not going any further. You're coming back around the other side. Anyway, it's always great fun, and I can usually hear the Australians early in the morning. It's seasonal. It also changes with the solar cycle, and we are now on the down slope. It's going down. It's getting worse, but.
Well, and Bill, I think you and I are the only two holders of the Workdal Rarotonga Club.
And I always want to point out that Rarotonga, it should be a much more kind of desired DX location, because the name itself smacks of rarity. Rarotonga, all right? Yes, and I have worked both the North Cook Islands and the South Cook Islands. All right, so I've got that. I got that award. I think I'm ready. But I've been doing this on 20 and on 17. On 17, I did notice something, that the receiver was kind of deaf. I made a comparison to my Drake 2B. The homebrew receiver did not really stack up all that well against the old Drake 2B. So I pulled out the Tia amp that we were talking about, the one that it was used an RF amp at the input, and I had it set at about 10 dB. And I realized, well, I could probably use another 10 dB. So I changed three resistors. I pulled out the board, popped out the resistors, popped in three different resistors. And Bob was my uncle. Things sounded much better. I mean, I could hear the band noise before, but it was very faint. Now I turned it on. I turned the switch to the hex beam antenna, and boom, the band noise is there. So you don't want to go too far with this. It's all very unscientific, but it was good. I've been on 75 meters on AM. I know.
Wow.
Pete is shocked. I know.
Wow.
It's kind of scary.
Do you have ailments you can discuss?
I guess we could.
mean, that's good. That's a ticket to ride.
It would
So
have.
there's a reason they call that the organ recital, Bill. Had a problem with the prostate.
I'm going to talk about it now for the next 45 minutes, even though you guys don't want to hear about it. It also helps, I think, if you're drunk, and I am usually not. I'm never drunk, but I realize that that's not the rule followed by everybody else. However, for many years, I've been listening to the old military radio net. The old military radio net meets, get this, the official beginning of the net is at 5 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Oh, dark 30.
5 a.m. And I mentioned this at the radio club, and even the guys at the Vienna Wireless Society were taken aback. They said, 5 o'clock? You mean like 5 o'clock in the morning? I said, yeah, 5 o'clock in the morning. They were like, whoa, that's hardcore. It is. And
To
these guys.
be fair, what time is it there now, Pete?
It's 6:14.
Well, Pete, Pete is doing heroic work for the podcast for many years here. But anyway, 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's almost, as the name indicates, old military radios, a lot of BC-348s, a lot of ART-13s, a lot of dynamotors heard in the background. But you know that some of the discouraging stuff in there is that more and more SDR rigs. I mean, why check in to the old military radio net on AM, running AM on your ICOM 7300? I mean, I don't know. It seems kind of unseemly to me, especially when I try to check in with my DX100 and it immediately provokes a lot of complaints. Well, the audio is a little bit off there, old man. What kind of microphone are you using? But anyway,
40 hertz low.
well, that's one thing that doesn't come up, because I watch the old military radio net. I could watch it on the web SDR that Mehmet and A5B runs down here in Springfield, which is just, a couple miles down the road. So I can, as I'm speaking on the DX100, I'm watching my carrier, and I noticed that the carriers that these guys are putting out, it's supposed to be 3885, which is the old World War II walkie-talkie frequency, but it's actually 3884, 3885, 3886. It's somewhere in there, and it doesn't really seem to matter that much. But hey, I wanted to mention something. I had some when I first I got my antenna for 75 meters had been blown down while we were in the Dominican Republic by one of the horrible winter storms that took place up here. Dean, you remember this, right? Boom, horrible storm. I was down there in the tropics, far away from it, but watching it on ring camera, and I could almost see my antenna falling down. So we finally got the antenna back up. It's a 75 meter doublet fed with window line with a homebrew tuner out there on that I've got strapped onto the carport outside. And I thought I was ready to go. I was going to be able to check in again to the old military radio net. Man, as soon as I keyed the transmitter, I started getting this hellacious noise, this buzzing sound. And I looked, and Mehmet down the road in Springfield is not picking up the same thing, but I am. It's local. So I disconnect the antenna. Yeah, it's coming in through the antenna. It's for real. It's not being generated by the DX100 and the HQ Hammerlin HQ100. And it took me a couple minutes to realize what was going on. It was a light bulb, an LED light bulb in right outside the door there that I had turned on. I went over, I was about ready to turn off the power in the house to see if the noise disappeared, but I didn't even have to do that because as soon as I turned the light switch to the off position, the noise disappeared. So RFI solved. Hey, one other thing I want to mention, a couple other things I want to mention. One is my adventure with the 1964 Parks Electronics converter from 2 meters to 20 meters. All right. Using NuVista tubes, NuVistas. So I picked up one of these things at a ham fest a while back. It was probably at the Winter Fest. I don't know. But I picked it up and it's just been sitting there on my shelf. And I started somehow reading, I was reading an Asianometry about how there was a valiant attempt by RCA to come out with NuVistas. To kind of head off the onslaught of the transistors. Good luck with that. But I plugged this thing in. I had already gone through and changed the electrolytic caps, so the voltages were right. But I was wondering if these NuVistas from 1964 still work. So I plugged it in for a while and I put my fingers up on top of those little NuVista tubes. They were getting warm, right? There's filaments in there. They were heating up the NuVistas. Then I turned on the oscillator, and I had sitting next to it the tiny SA, the spectrum analyzer. The oscillator is supposed to be running at 43.333 megahertz. It wasn't. There was no signal there, nothing. It was dead. So here's where AI comes in. So this is a 1964 to esoteric, very esoteric device produced in Beaverton, Oregon, 1964 by Parks Electronics. And I ask AI, I have a 1964 example of a converter, Parks Electronics 6W4, 6CW4 NuVistas, and I can't get the oscillator to work. What do you think is the problem? Boom. Right away, they had the answer. They said, check the crystal. Crystal's probably bad. And I figured it's not in one of those old World War II style FT-243 cases. It's all sealed up. And I started searching around the junk box. Amazingly, and this is amazing, I have another 43.333 megahertz
Wow.
crystal. I popped that new one in there, bam, it was the crystal. The crystal was bad. And AI was right. So we got to give the devil his due. So anyway, I haven't done anything with it. It was just fun to get it going, to feel the new visitors getting hot, and to get the oscillator going. But
So your LED light reminded me. I was restoring the Hallicrafters worldwide, and this is one of these, battery radios that it's equivalent to the other famous multi-band
the transoceanic.
transoceanic, right? It's the Hallicrafters version of it, and it was driving me crazy because on certain frequencies it would just take off like a banshee and hiss and go crazy, and I got and it sounded awful. And I finally got our friend Grayson, to get on a Holostate Design Grayson, get on a Zoom video with me, and we spent a couple hours diagnosing, and we were changing tubes out, putting alternate circuits in place, and we couldn't figure it out. And at the end of the day, it was a wall wart for a battery charger that did it. And my brother, who's a ham, Whiskey Six Charlie Sierra, Chris, he says, take the radio to a different room and see if it does it there. I said, what is that going to do? I said, what do you mean take it to a different room? Physics don't change by the room. He said, just do it. And sure enough, I took it to a different room, but I said,
Wow.
oh, it's environment.
Well, I had you guys will remember a while back I had very bad RFI problems across all the bands. And it was right above me in the room right above upstairs was a treadmill. The treadmill was off, but the treadmill was plugged in. And I was watching, I could see all the noise spikes on the tiny SA. It was sitting right here. And I just reached over. I had an instinctive feel for what it might be. And I unplugged the treadmill. And as soon as I unplugged it, those spikes disappeared. The noise disappeared from all the bands. The circuit was active when it was plugged in, not when it was turned on, when it was just plugged in.
Probably a battery charger, yeah.
And probably something like that. It was bad. It's RFI. I also had a problem here a few years ago when I was getting RFI, but the directional antenna helped a little bit too, because I would swing the antenna around and I knew it was coming from that direction. Now, that's all I knew. It could have been coming from that direction, 400, 500 miles away, or it could have been right down the road. And one day a few days later, I was riding my bike to work and I came around the corner and exactly in that direction, I saw the telephone pole smoking. And the power company frantically coming out trying to put out the fire. That's what it was. But anyway, one final thing is I'm thinking about audio derived S meters. I have all this homebrew gear here. They're all based on the BitX. They don't have any automatic gain control because, as we know, real hams manually control their gain, right? Automatic gain control now. We don't have that. But I've been thinking about the circuits for audio derived S meters. Even though I know it's completely, unreliable, meaningless, bogus, it all depends on which way the antenna is going. Well, it depends on which kind of antenna you're using. But I have a couple little meters here, and the circuits are very simple. So I might be thinking about putting an audio derived S meter into these rigs just so that I could watch the needle bounce around when the other guy starts speaking. Anyway, that's what I'm talking. Hey, guys, it's time for Solder Smoke Mailbag. All right. Mailbag. The first one is somebody that Dean just mentioned, our good buddy Grayson, KJ7UM. He also expressed admiration for Helgi LA6NCA. This is Grayson's his roots are in thermotrons, in tubes. This solid, hollow state designed for the radio amateur. Definitely get the book. It deserves a place on every shelf of every true radio amateur. He also sent around a video of a nice 6L6 rig that was really good. So it was always good to hear from Grayson. Hidehiko is JA9MAT. He was the one who sent us the video of the super regen that I and AI at first doubted whether it was a super regen or a regular old regen. But it was a super regen. And this was something that was invented by E. Howard Armstrong many, many years ago. And we managed, this is where eventually AI gave in and announced that I am absolutely right. And it is, and Hidehiko was absolutely right too.
Just
But
keep
one
in
of the,
mind one thing, Bill.
what?
Armstrong's birthday is the same birthday as Brad Pitt and the same as mine,
I,
December the 18th.
now we've got, we,
The
is it November,
company
November
is
18th?
December.
December. Okay, good.
This
All
is,
right.
we're in good company.
You're a good company. Yeah. Let's see. But oh yeah, but Hidehiko, AJA9MAT, he sends us a video, and in the video, I couldn't believe it. I had never seen this before. Somebody else in the world has the VFO boxes from an FT101. I thought Dean and I were the only ones. Pete, you might have one also, but Hidehiko has it. I wrote to him and I said, "My God, there's somebody else buying these things. You too." And he was like, I think he just got it because he actually wanted the what originally attracted us, which was the anti-backslash gears. We of course discovered that the entire 9 megahertz VFO is still in the box, and we put that to good use. But so someone else is using the VFOs from the FT101. Thank you very much for confirming that we are not alone, Hidehiko, JA9MAT. Chuck WB9KZY, he sent us a really cool video on some covert listening devices from the UK. They built these little transmitters inside matchboxes, and they would leave them like on the table of the office that they wanted to listen to after they left the meeting. And then for the receiver, they used a little simple weather radio. They got a little weather radio and they would listen on the weather radio. I guess you'd go to the next room and there was enough RF being produced by the thing. So it was a kind of a cool video. I have it up on the blog. Paul VK3HN, he was really recently interviewed by Charlie at Red Summit RF. Paul VK3HN is a very prolific long-term home brewer, but he had earlier in the month sent us an example of an Australian CBLA rig, the Color Burst Liberation Army. I'm glad to know that the Color Burst Liberation Army is alive and well in Australia. Thank you for Paul for sending that. We also, this is one of the builds that Dean had mentioned. I think we're up at 138 now of the direct conversion receiver. Andre, his location, Bandung, West Java, Indonesia. He doesn't even have a ham radio license. I said he should get one just for successfully building this receiver. He has done something that most radio amateurs never, ever, ever do. He built it. He got it working. So three cheers for Andre, and he built it. He actually showed great initiative because instead of just sitting around whining about how hard it was to get the transformer from Mauser, he's in Bandung, West Java, Indonesia. And so he's not going to be placing any orders to Mauser anytime soon. He says he found the transformer that he thought would work in an old Japanese transistor radio. And I said, give it a try. It's probably going to work. And it works like a charm. So thank you. Thank you, Andre, for sending that and for reminding us that, you know, it is possible to build radios even if you can't place an order to Mauser. Mike WN2A, he liked my post explaining why AM is on 3885 on 75 meters. Not everyone did. So this is one of the posts that provoked complaints about my use of AI slop. Ugh. Anyway, thanks for sending that in, Mike. Walter KA4KXX, he liked the piece I put out about Hans and how Hans broke the code and really broke the logjam in generating I and Q signals from the SI-5351. We forget that before Hans, there was really no good way to get I and Q. You'd have the SI-5351 signal, but then you to break it down, to split it into, half of the signal was at in phase, half was 90 degrees off I and Q, which was essential for good SDR receivers. Nobody had done that until Hans Sommers, G0UPL, figured out how to do it. Hans cracked the code on the SI-5351, and I think that's something that we should remember. Dean and I, Pete, we've spared you most of this, have been in conversations with some of our Australian friends, Peter VK3TPM and Paul VK3HN, who I mentioned earlier, also Bob KD4EBM. We've kind of been sharing discussion articles about AI and what it means. And I guess the real issue is whether AI is becoming conscious or not. And I think the answer is no, it's not becoming conscious. It might be becoming quite intelligent, but I have a calculator here that I'll hold up, and I'll point out that this calculator is quite intelligent. It's much better at math. It can get the third square root of any number you give to it. Doesn't mean that it's conscious. It's not sitting there thinking about what it's going to do next after lunch, something like that. So we've been talking about that. Ryan KJ7KVD, he's one of the fellows who I did with Dean. Dean was one of the first people that I did this with. I sent him the crystal for the 3579. Now it resulted in a bit of a scandal here in Northern Virginia. It's a long, sad story. We've talked about it before, but I managed to avoid arrest by sending KJ7 KVD Ryan, and he's going to build it when family duties permit. So we have probably a new member of the Color Burst Liberation Army
So I'm
in process.
assuming you included enough postage, Bill.
I probably did. I think I did.
Excellent.
I might have admitted to the post office that this was a parcel,
Not a letter.
not a letter. That was my problem before. Trying to rip them off, man, for 23 cents. I know. I hang my head in shame. All right. Let's see. We heard from Chris KD4PBJ. He's a noted solder smoke listener. And he signed in. He was at an event, and they had a sign-in sheet, and he signed in for solder smoke. So thank you for doing that, Chris. We also are making good use of the parts that Chris sent. Chris sent both of us some, all of us some parts, I think. And there are some really high-powered transistors in there that are just tempting us to be included in a high-powered amplifier of some sort. So one of these days. Eric 4Z1UG interviewed Will N5OLA. N5OLA, that's Will down in South Padre Island. The heat kit guru. The guy who puts the heat kits HW101s in the dishwasher. Pete is making that move into the dishwasher. Soapy suds. Ooh, scary as heck. It, really scary. But then he takes it out and leaves it in the sun at South Padre Island, Texas. Anyway,
I'm assuming there's no misses.
well, well, I don't know.
I would not get away with
I don't think I would either. I would have to get another dishwasher of some sort. But anyway, he interviewed Will, and it's a really good interview. It's on Eric 4Z1UG. I have the sites. It's on the QSO Today website. So really good. K6AUS. We talked to K6AUS Scott a lot because he's been the guy involved in trying to use the German serial number example to determine how many Drake 2B receivers were built by Drake in the lifetime of the Drake 2B. The answer is probably in the area around 11,000,
Wow.
but and you could tell that by just looking at the distribution of the available serial numbers that we have available to us now. And so the prospect probably around 11,000, but recently he's discovered that there may be a gap We know that the Drake started numbering the Drake 2Bs at 2000, but we have seen no examples of any Drake 2Bs with serial numbers between 3000 and 4000. So this raises an interesting problem. Was there a reason that Drake did it this way? And we don't know, but we're still looking at it. And I am looking for a Drake 2B for Scott, K6AUS. They've got to be out there. Heck, there were 11,000 of these things built. They got to be out there. And believe me, you're not going to get megabucks for this thing at the Hamfest. It's a Drake 2B. It's a nice receiver, but you're not going to get a whole lot of money for it. So we're looking for somebody who's willing to donate to a good cause, somebody who really appreciates the receiver. That's Scott, K6AUS. Let me know, and I'll do what I can to facilitate the transfer. Finally, we heard from Farhan. Farhan is doing well. He's working on some other projects, some of which are ham radio related, but he's doing well, and it was good to hear from him. Gentlemen, that's the end of Solder Smoke Mailbag. You got any? Yep.
I got one more mailbag,
Tell
one
me,
more mailbag.
tell me, tell.
So I got a very nice note from Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z, friend of the podcast, QST editor, former editor of the ARL Handbook, former assistant managing editor at QST. And as he signs off, friends of the podcast forever in parentheses. Really nice note. And for me, it was particularly heartening because this is another kind of a luminary in our field. He's a home brewer. He is interested in possibly joining our Vienna Wireless Society maker group, which I've invited him to through our Zoom call. But he actually thanked me for my participation in the podcast. You know, my place on the learning curve is significantly different than either of yours. And I just thought it was a really nice note. And good to know that we're still being heard out there by guys like Kurt. Again, I don't get a lot of these notes. You get most of them, Bill, because they come to the Solder Smoke email, but I was very pleased to get that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I meant to include it, and I failed. But thanks, and it always is great to hear from Kirk. I know Pete also hears from him also from Kirk. He's always got some good insight. I think Kirk might have been one of the guys who tried to build the Herring 8-5 receiver. So I think that was one of the beginning discussions that we had. He had similar problems that I had. So I think if I recall correctly. Anyway, guys, hey Pete, thanks for getting up early in the morning. As Dean has pointed out, he's getting up at oh dark 30 there.
Six
Dean,
thirty-seven.
6:37. We've gone more than an hour here. Anyway,
Thirty.
Dean, thank you very much. I'll say 7:3 from Falls Church, Virginia.
7-3's from the left coast.
And 73 from Great Falls, Virginia.
Take care, guys. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.